Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Friends and neighbors, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's roundtable, where we look back at the big news of the week with three of Washington's top political reporters. Well, we're down to the home stretch now in the 2020 campaign, and campaign developments again dominated the news from Washington this week. Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden back on the road, with Trump holding a daily campaign rally and Biden smaller, safer events, all of them in key battleground states. A canceled second presidential debate was replaced last night by two competing town halls between rival candidates on rival networks. Meanwhile, Amy Coney Barrett sailed through confirmation hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And despite Donald Trump's promise that it was disappearing, the coronavirus spiked as part of a fall surge, with eight states yesterday reporting the highest number of cases since March. Here to help us make some sense of this busy week, Amanda Becker, national political reporter for 19th News. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
John Bennett, White House correspondent for The Independent. Hello, John.
Hello, Bill.
And Matt Gertz joining us again, senior fellow from Media Matters for America. Hey, Matt, good to see you.
Morning, Bill.
All right. Well, let's start with last night's town halls. Probably like you, I was flipping back and forth between ABC and NBC. The big news seemed to be Savannah Guthrie trying to get Donald Trump to condemn QAnon. As he had earlier said, he condemned white supremacy. Donald Trump, for some reason, won't go there. Here's that little exchange.
Let me ask you about QAnon. It is this theory that Democrats are a satanic pedophile ring and that you are the savior of that. Now, can you just once and for all state that that is completely not true? True, and disavow QAnon in its entirety?
I know nothing about QAnon.
I just told you.
I know very little. You told me, but what you tell me doesn't necessarily make it fact. I hate to say that. I know nothing about it. I do know they are very much against pedophilia. They fight it very hard.
So, Amanda, he doesn't know anything about them, but he knows all about they fight hard against pedophilia. What's this all about?
I mean, I guess that shows that the QAnon tactics are working, I guess, even on the White House, because that's what they do. You know, they use this Save the Children hashtag, and it reels a lot of people in. I find it hard to believe that he wouldn't have been told by advisors or other people that there's more to this movement, I guess, if we're going to come up with a word for it, because it's kind of like this loose network of every conspiracy theory under the sun at this point. But, you know, I feel like someone has to have said something to him about it at this point, one of his advisors. But he, you know, his answer last night was that he doesn't, you know, really know any of that stuff about them. I guess he has never Googled.
Well, but John, he talks about them a lot. He talks about them. He talks about not necessarily Proud Boys, but he certainly talks about Antifa, about these fringe groups. Are we to believe he really never heard of them?
No, I don't think we are. I thought Savannah did an amazing job last night. I thought she was the star of the night on both town halls.
And, agreed.
You know, there was no. There was no real flaw in what she did. The one question that I thought she could have asked him there was, well, sir, why haven't you had your staff bring you a one-page summary or brief you on what QAnon is? So, you know, we could have gotten a little more detail on why he hasn't asked, why he isn't more curious about this. But I don't think there's any doubt that he knows exactly what the group is. You know, we've seen him do this before with the white supremacist groups. If he thinks it will at all upset his base or parts of his base, then he's not going to easily denounce anything. And for some reason, he clearly thinks this might offend part of his base. And quite frankly, he needs every vote from that base he can get.
Yeah. I guess we should also point out there is a Republican congressional candidate supported by Kevin McCarthy, who is at least somewhat of a QAnon follower. So certainly it's been talked about in Republican circles. Matt, the big issue around the the town halls last night, of course, was that NBC, at the very last minute, scheduled the Trump town hall the very same night, the very same time that ABC was holding a town hall previously scheduled after Trump canceled out of the debate with Vice President Joe Biden. NBC's come in under for a lot of criticism before making that decision. Well-deserved, in your opinion?
I mean, I think that the knock on NBC here was that by giving them the town hall, giving him the town hall directly up against Biden's town hall, it was effectively rewarding him for blowing up the debate, which I think is an argument that has some credibility. On the other hand, I think it certainly was not a night that went well for the president. I agree that Savannah Guthrie's questions were quite good, maybe some of the best live television interviewing of the president that we've seen during his presidency. And I just think you saw him not only on QAnon, but on the coronavirus, really being forced to answer questions that he didn't want to. Guthrie was extremely good at asking simple, factual questions, and when the president tried to run away from them, asking them again and again until it became clear, until he either had to give an answer or it became clear to everyone watching that he was avoiding doing so. So it was a very good job.
Right. The contrast between the two town halls, the two candidates, the two moderators, could not have been more stark. I thought it was like watching a snooze fest on one, or a wonky policy discussion on one, and a real lively back and forth and debate on the other. But Amanda, in the end, did this change anything, do you think?
Probably not. You know, I'm not sure even if they had debated one-on-one, it would have changed anything. Because when you looked at the ratings of the last one, they weren't that good. And it was such a train wreck. If I was an undecided voter, I would turn the TV off and walk away. So, you know, I'm not sure that any of this is really moving the dial at this point, despite the fact that, you know, ostensibly in the audiences, they found kind of the last five undecided voters in America.
Right. Well, John, let's talk about that, because I checked before we came on this morning, what Real Clear Politics is reporting, right? Because we can't go through all the polls. But this has been consistent for some time now. Real Clear Politics has Joe Biden up nationwide over Donald Trump by 9.4% points. And just a couple of the battleground states, Real Clear Politics, Biden over Trump, Florida, 2.7, North Carolina, 2.9, Pennsylvania, 6.5, Michigan, 7.2, Minnesota, 6.6. Is Trump running out of time? Is there time to turn this around? What's it look like to you?
Yeah, I think he is running out of time. But, you know, all the polls say that Joe Biden should win this thing. He should win the popular vote nationally. He is up by enough, and I'm like you, I go by the Real Clear averages. I do an adjustment on most polls. I go +3 for Trump and -3 for Biden because, and this is the reason that I'm certainly not ready to make a prediction. When you adjust +/-3 for that shy Trump voter, and this is what happened 4 years ago, yep. You know, the polls didn't capture folks who were just a little shy, or a lot shy about saying they supported Donald Trump. I think that voter is still very much out there. They don't answer the phone. They don't say yes when they're asked certain questions. But, you know, they might tell their family members that they love Trump, or they might talk at church that they love Trump, that kind of thing. So when you do the adjustment, this race looks a lot different. In fact, it starts to look like a dead heat. So it starts to look like a dead heat in those six or seven swing states that are going to decide the election. So Trump is running out of time, and I don't think yelling at Savannah Guthrie does much to help him with women, college-educated white women, which he's been losing. And especially with seniors, which he's been losing since the day he walked into the White House. So he's running out of time, but oddly, he has enough time, because I'm not sure the race is quite at the margin in favor of Vice President Biden as it looks on paper.
Yeah. Matt, I want to come back to you, but while I want to get Amanda's take on his appeal to women. I mean, it was so flat out begging for their support at a rally the other day where he said, please, women, please, please like me, please like me, please, please, please like me, as if he knows that's his problem, right?
So it's absolutely his problem, although I do agree with John that these swing state polls are a lot closer than people, than the way people are talking about the state of this race right now, I guess. A lot of the swing state polls are still within the margin of error, even though Biden is leading, and I do agree that there are shy Trump voters. I do think within the last couple of weeks, when I have circled back to women who I've been talking to, and also there are panels that I have watched of undecided women in swing states done by a wonderful never Trump GOP strategist named Sarah Longwell, she said for the first time the other night, all the women on her panel said they were voting for Biden. Because, you know, until this point, the women don't like Trump. They voted for him in 2016. They rate his performance as bad or very bad. But they still needed to get over that last hump to say, not only do I not like Trump, I'm going to vote for Biden. I think that is starting to happen. I think it had to do with that train wreck of a debate I mentioned earlier. I think it had to do with the president's COVID diagnosis and how that was handled, how that played out. And if he loses more women than he's already lost, because that's who's deciding this election. I mean, women are the only voters, every study shows, that are changing their minds. And we're seeing 20-point gender gaps in some of the swing states, with women just across every demographic group. We're not only talking about college-educated white women in the suburbs anymore. It's becoming more broad than that.
Yeah. And so, Matt, perhaps one of the signs that even Republicans think the president might not pull this off and might actually bring some of them down is a remarkable recording that was released yesterday by the Washington Examiner of Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, who was early on pretty critical of Donald Trump. In fact, I think he said he didn't vote for him in 2016. But then he's mellowed a little bit this year when he was running in the primary in Nebraska. He's up in November. But now he's swinging back, and he had a phone conference call town hall with constituents in Nebraska. 17,000 people signed up for it. And he was asked by one constituent, what about your relationship with Donald Trump? Here is just a little bit of Ben Sasse's remarkable response.
His are deficient, not just for a Republican, but for an American. So the way he kisses dictators' butts, it isn't just that he fails to lead our allies, it's that the United States now regularly sells out our allies under his leadership. The way he treats women and spends like a drunken sailor, he mocks evangelicals behind closed doors. His family has treated the presidency like a business opportunity. He's flirted with white supremacists. At the beginning of the COVID crisis, he refused to treat it seriously for months. He treated it like a news cycle by news cycle PR crisis rather than a multi-year public health challenge, which is what it is. Donald Trump didn't win the presidency because America actually wants more reality TV, round-the-clock, stupid political obsession. I think the overwhelming reason that President Trump won in 2016 was simply because Hillary Clinton was literally the most unpopular candidate in the history of polling.
So, Matt, I want to point out that, again, was not me speaking. That was Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska. What does that tell us?
I never know what to think of these, like, these statements by Republicans behind closed doors about how Trump is actually bad, because in the in public, none of that really happens. You see them lining up behind him. Ben Sasse there is saying a lot of very strong things about President Trump, none of which are enough to get him to not endorse him for re-election. And so the whole thing is just kind of a weird sham. And I just don't know how to process it exactly.
Does Ben Sasse, do you believe, reflect... Is it more than just Ben Sasse that feels this way? Is this maybe a starting to spread among Republican senators, particularly those up for re-election?
I think so. I think this isn't new. I talked to, back when I was running around on the Hill, I talked to numerous Republican senators off the record, ones who I had gotten to know, and there was some trust there. It was frustrating that they wouldn't say things like that on the record or even on background, but that is a prevailing way of thinking in the Senate Republican caucus, especially what Senator Sasse said about President Trump's spending and his desire to spend. We see that, at least we think we see that, in what the New York Times got a hold of with his tax documents, and he loves to spend. That's why he's going to owe, who knows who he owes, actually, $300 million over the next few years. And we're seeing that play out right now. Senator Sasse and others, their frustration with the president on another COVID relief bill. He mm-hmm. now says he wants to go even bigger than Nancy Pelosi, who wants to go pretty darn big. But Senate Republicans, they want to go pretty small if they do anything. And I bet that was on Senator Sasse's mind right now, because the president's been all over the place on this this COVID relief bill. And now, you know, he wants to spend more than Nancy Pelosi. And that just frustrates them to no end. And he, at least on paper, he looks like a drag at the ballot box. So there's a lot of frustration there. But it's been there the entire term. And we've seen it come out in moments like this. But in a second term, as long as he keeps nominating judges they like, you know, I think we'll see individual episodes like that. But for the most part, they'll bite their tongue and try to make the best of it.
By the way, I saw a note this morning that it is the 1 year anniversary today since Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi spoke on the phone or in person. One year.
Happy anniversary, everyone.
So the idea that he's been involved in these negotiations with her about stimulus is just not the case. So, Amanda, you're out there on the road a lot. As of today, 17 million Americans have already voted. Mm-hmm. And there's some reports that more people may vote before November 3rd than actually vote on November 3rd this year. What does it tell us? What's going on?
Now, I don't think we're going to know exactly what that's telling us in terms of impact on the election until it's all over, simply because there's an unprecedented amount of early voting this year, including in places that have never done it before.
And who's it help? Republicans or Democrats?
That's what I'm not sure. And, you know, it also, if something does happen, you know, we're probably... You know, there's always what's called the October surprise. I feel like this entire election is a surprise in some ways, the past month or so. It's just one surprise after another. You know, maybe we'll get one a day, like an advent calendar or something. So it's hard to assess kind of what could change it at this point with so many votes already cast. You know, some states start to report kind of breakdowns and start counting the votes. Others don't. It just depends on where you live. Some early returns that I've seen, I think it was out of Georgia, had really interesting splits in terms of party registration and who's voting early and absentee versus waiting until Election Day. It seemed there that Trump supporters were waiting until Election Day. So I don't know if that means that people are holding off, waiting to see if something else happens that might change their mind at the last second. We're really just going to have to sort this all out once we get those votes in.
Mm-hmm. Matt, what about the October surprise? Where is it and what is it?
It's all around us. The October surprise is that 1,000 Americans died of COVID yesterday, and that 1,000 Americans are going to die from COVID today, and 1,000 Americans are going to die from COVID tomorrow, and that's going to continue up through and past the election. This was all incredibly predictable. The public health experts have been screaming that the fall flu season was coming and that the virus was going to get worse if we didn't get it under control, and the president didn't get it under control. And now we are in this situation where Americans will continue to die through the election, and that will remain the number one story in America until and well past Election Day. And that is toxic for the president because it was his job to prevent this from happening, and he failed.
And Matt, I want to point out that you and I have talked about this before, but back in March, you reported for Media Matters that the more Donald Trump listened to Fox and repeated what he was hearing on Fox about this not being a serious matter, the more people were going to die. I'm sure you take pleasure in being correct, but it's worked out.
I do not. I mean, this was always the nightmare scenario. I have been studying the president's obsession with Fox News throughout his administration and before. He watches hours of it a day. It shapes his worldview. He consults with the network's hosts for advice about what the government should do. And the two most dangerous scenarios were a confrontation with a nuclear armed country and this, a pandemic, a scenario where immense public resources would need to be harnessed and communications to the public about what to do. And rather than taking advice from experts in public health and epidemiology, the president watches Fox News and takes their advice instead. I said back in March, this is what was going to happen. If Rupert Murdoch and Lachlan Murdoch did not get their hosts under control, they would continue to feed him stories about miracle cures and about how masks are bad, and so on and so forth. And that's exactly what happened.
Right.
A lot of people are dead because
right.
of it.
I want to talk more about coronavirus and its impact on the 2020 election with all of you. But let's take a quick break here now on the Bill Press Pod, our roundtable today with Amanda Baker from 19th News, John Bennett from The Independent, and Matt Gertz, Media Matters for America. It's the Bill Press Pod. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. And today's roundtable brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, the good men and women of the UFCW under President Mark Perron. They're the great people who serve us in our big major retail stores like Safeway or Stop and Shop, in our chemical plants, distillery plants, cannabis plants, and food processing, beef and chicken processing plants all across the country on the front lines in these days of the coronavirus pandemic. We salute them for their good work, staying on the job, fighting the good fight, and for their support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at ufcw.org.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole?
Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Matt Gaetz joining us from Media Matters for America. On today's roundtable, John Bennett from The Independent, Amanda Becker, a national political reporter for 19th News. So, John, just before the break, Matt was talking about the coronavirus. Do you agree that it is still going to be either the major or one of the major factors in this 2020 election?
I do. I think there are a number of major factors going back to the October surprise idea. This is an episode of Monday Night Raw where, you know, anything's possible at any moment. It's a television show. I thought this week that one thing Senate Judiciary Democrats failed to do was, you know, they put on a hearing. But a confirmation hearing like that for a Supreme Court justice in this day and age is more of a television show. And I didn't think that reading 4-minute, 5-minute long, if you're Senator Hirono, 6-minute long blocks of beefy, difficult legal decisions is very effective. So because it's a television show, and to Matt's point, because Donald Trump is so tuned into cable news, especially Fox, he is going to treat this like a television show. He steps on stage at 1:30 to give a speech on protecting America's seniors. Of course, as we've discussed already, he's been losing older voters. So, you know, that is an official event, but it's a campaign event at the same time. Anything's possible. I'm sure he'll talk about COVID. Of course, as he said, he's vulnerable like other seniors. He got it. He was pretty sick. At least one second he says he's pretty sick, and the next second he says as soon as he got powerful drugs that no other American has access to, he felt like Superman. So anything's possible. Yes, COVID's going to be an issue. His handling of it's going to be an issue, but it'll be swept away by the next thing out of his mouth or the next thing he tweets.
Yeah, and Amanda, one of the issues, of course, continues to be the question of wearing a mask. The president last night danced all around the mask, saying, yeah, he was for them, but then studies show they don't work, which is not true. People can wear them or not wear them. He does not require them at his rallies. Meantime, on ABC, Joe Biden was asked about masks by George Stephanopoulos and taking a very strong and just the opposite approach. Here's Vice President Biden.
No matter whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, they matter. And when a president doesn't wear a mask or makes fun of folks like me when I was wearing a mask for a long time, then, as you know, people say, well, it mustn't be that important. But when a president says, I think this is very important, for example, I walked in here with this mask, but I have one of the N95 masks underneath it. I think it matters what we say. So there's a long way to go, but we can make progress in the meantime and save lives.
So does this penetrate? Does this message get out, Amanda?
Well, you know, there's a gender divide on coronavirus and precautions, as well as this election more broadly. Hmm. Women tend to wear masks and take more precautions than men do. And, you know, I'm sure I've heard there's tension. I've heard from people directly, there's tension about this in their own families. You know, they think their husband should be taking more precaution than they are. In a lot of cases, women tell me. And I just have to imagine that, especially after having the virus himself not that long ago, of course, they say he's better, but we don't see any of the tests or anything in real time, the president's test. And he was squishy last night on whether he had gotten a negative result and when, ahead of the debate with Joe Biden. So, you know, and then he was at a rally earlier this week, and I saw clips of him throwing masks from the stage when he wasn't wearing one, kind of like a, you know, who needs this sort of move. You know, I don't think that a lot of women, especially these undecided women in the suburbs and the exurbs, are particularly impressed by displays of male bravado and ego in the middle of a pandemic, when a lot of them have their kids at home because they can't go back to school. They might be caring for immunocompromised children, immunocompromised parents if they're in the sandwich generation. They might be older themselves. They might have health issues themselves. And I think that this will hurt the president.
Yeah. Matt, I want to circle back with John mentioned the Supreme Court hearing this week, which was, I don't know, it was not that exciting and foreordained, I think. Everybody admitted we know what the outcome is going to be. Do you see that as a television show, that the Democrats take advantage of it? And secondly, do you see it having, whether they vote or not, looks like they will, any impact on 2020?
I mean, I don't think it's going to shake up 2020 in any real way. And frankly, at this point, it's difficult for me to know what would. You know, this has been a very, very, very consistent election. You know, for all the twists and turns it has had, the fundamentals have been, Joe Biden with a large lead basically from the beginning. And so what exactly would make that change is, I think, difficult to say. I think it could become a rallying cry for progressives, but progressives are pretty amped up as it is already. You know, on the sort of reality TV show point, I think we're going to have to rewire our brains a little bit if Joe Biden wins this election, because it's not going to be healthy to be constantly looking for antics and Trump-level stuff in a administration that will be like trying to do basic public policy things and behave responsibly. More to the point, Trump isn't going to go away. He's going to be watching Fox News and tweeting about what he sees and going on that network to say crazy stuff. And if the press spends all its time focused on that instead of what is actually happening in a Biden administration, I think they will be doing a major disservice to their audiences in order to get, to have more fun with the mm-hmm. crazier stories. And so I think that's a real pitfall that journalists could be walking into in a Biden administration.
All right. We note your warning. John, that reminds me of one of the moments in the Trump NBC town hall that I found really fascinating and hasn't gotten much attention was, and I forget, it was some crazy thing that Savannah Guthrie asked the president about, why did you tweet this? And the president said, oh, that was just a retweet. And she said, yeah, but you're the president of the United States. Right. You're not some guy's crazy uncle who just could retweet anything he wants. Why? What do you see about? What is this passion of retweeting something that is totally bogus, nonsense, crazy? And he does it all the time.
A lot of folks think that Trump acts on impulse, and I think that's true a lot of the time. But there is a calculated aspect to just about everything he does. And he's acknowledged that one day at one of these call-in interviews that it's the retweets that get you in trouble. He said something along those lines. And the next morning, he's retweeting things that easily could have gotten him in trouble. So he knows it's a risk, and he continues to do it. It's a way to signal to especially that the forest far right part of his base that he's one of them, or he hears them, or that he's there for them. I think he sees a lot of plausible deniability in that statement, that it's just a retweet, that it's an interesting idea that I thought I would share, but I don't necessarily agree with it 100%. That's vintage Trump, because he also says things at rallies and in these interviews, you know, some people are saying, and I think it's along those lines. So it, in his mind, at least, it gives him that plausible deniability. But, you know, I know what I'm doing when I hit the retweet button. But, you know, it's just another one of these things that the guy seems to get away with, because as Matt and Amanda have both said, the race has been so steady, his numbers don't move all that much. And there's just this sense that he gets away with stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think we could all agree that if you retweet something, you're basically endorsing it, right? You're putting your name behind that tweet. Right.
You're certainly not denouncing it.
Yeah. Right. So finally, we had this week something so reminiscent of 2016 happen. Amanda, we have a case in the New York Post of emails found, emails that prove there's a big conspiracy, in this case, not Hillary Clinton, but Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Ukraine all over again. Should we be paying any attention to this, or is this obvious Russian propaganda?
You know, I would, as from a voter's perspective, no, I would not be paying attention to that story. To me, as a journalist, what really struck me about this was Twitter's decision to censor it and block links to that story.
Yeah.
While there has been pressure on social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, all of them, to deal with disinformation, I think that censoring content from an ostensibly actual news organization, a real news story, is a very slippery slope. I don't think they have been very transparent, Twitter, about how they plan to approach this. It's, to my knowledge, the first time they've done it with a news story. And I'm very interested to see what happens with this going forward, because that's a road I'm very uncomfortable going down.
How do you read it, Matt?
I agree, and I think that they've already walked it back to some extent.
The New York Post?
Twitter. On the Twitter front part of it, Twitter put out some statements last night, basically saying that this was an overzealous approach and that they were going to move in a direction of adding information to tweets rather than keeping links like that from circulating altogether, which I think is to the good. I think the underlying story here from the New York Post is not terribly interesting. It attempts to make the same connection between Joe Biden and the firing of a Ukrainian prosecutor, and again tries to make that a story about Joe Biden trying to help Hunter Biden's business interests. We know that that isn't true from when this story came up last year, and so the rest of it is just sort of filler. You know, obviously, there's an interesting story about where these emails came from. The provenance appears to be the story that we're getting is that the provenance is Hunter Biden leaving his laptop at a Delaware computer repair store. The owner eventually looking at the emails, calling the FBI, making a copy of the computer, and then later providing it to Rudy Giuliani's lawyer, and Rudy Giuliani then providing some of the emails to the New York Post. which is all incredibly sketchy. Then, of course, there's the secondary layer, which is that Russian intelligence services who hacked Democratic organizations in 2016 appear to have hacked the Ukrainian company that Hunter Biden was working for earlier this year, and that Rudy Giuliani has been working with someone who has been sanctioned by the Treasury Department as an active Russian agent in order to produce disinformation about Joe Biden to help Donald Trump's reelection campaign. So that doesn't look great either. But yeah, again, I don't think this will upset the fundamentals of the election in any real way. I think that it's just not going anywhere, and we won't be talking about it in a couple of days.
And I just want to point out, John, before you comment, headline in this morning's New York Times, White House was warned Giuliani was conveying Russian disinformation. That was apparently reported to the White House by the National Security Advisor, Robert C. O'Brien, back in last December.
Yeah, not surprising. The same story, I believe, says that President Trump kind of shrugged that off when O'Brien told him that. So, again, it goes back to the president believes that you know, he throws elbows, he plays rough, sometimes he plays dirty, and this is an example of playing dirty. And, you know, he's got this weird relationship with Rudy. If he's asked about Rudy, he won't even say clearly that Rudy is one of his lawyers. So he lets Rudy go out here and say all these things because he thinks it'll help him, usually with the base. So, you know, it's all about the base. We keep coming back to that.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, you know, Trump's fine with Rudy saying all kinds of things. I mean, Rudy said all kinds of things the last 4 years, and he's invited to White House events, and he's by the president's side. So, you know, I would expect 4 more years of that if Trump finds a way to win in a couple weeks.
And of course, Rudy Giuliani is dealing with another problem today, which is that his daughter has come out, Caroline, his daughter has come out and endorsed Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Family feud there in the Giuliani household. Great panel, John Bennett, Matt Gaetz, Amanda Becker. But before we let you go, two things. One, we want to find out. I want you to tell us how people can follow you when you're not here on the Bill Press Pod, but also want to hear your favorite story of the week. There must have been something along the way, political or not, something we've talked about or not, that caught your attention. Amanda, you want to lead us off, your favorite story of the week?
Sure. You know, for the first time ever, I think I'm going to do one of my own stories and I can tell you one in the New Yorker about the same race that ran yesterday, because mine was a few days ago. They're both about the Maine Senate race. I think that there's such interesting Senate races happening right now that are not getting a lot of attention because Trump sucks the air out of everything always. You see a lot of these competitive races tightening in some cases, getting even more competitive. Democrats that we didn't think had a chance are now polling even or even pulling ahead. And so I think that's really an under-talked about story that's happening right now, because the control of the Senate, either way the White House goes, is going to be really critical and make a huge difference. And so I would say some of these Senate stories, and if you can do us something to watch, I would say there was a pretty lit Iowa Senate debate last night happening at the same time as the town halls Senator Joni Ernst kind of stepped in it a little bit. They asked her, and she's being challenged by Teresa Greenfield. They asked them both what the break-even price was on key Iowa crops. And Greenfield went first and got corn and got it immediately. And then they moved to Joni, and she was asked about soybeans, and she could not answer. And in an Iowa Senate debate, that is a pretty big moment.
Indeed. Indeed, it is. Someone called it the most Midwestern moment of any Senate debate ever. Matt, how about you?
Well, as regular listeners of this podcast know, I always use this opportunity to talk about my favorite media conspiracy theory, which is that the Democratic Socialists of America have infiltrated the real estate sections of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and are using their coverage of the uber wealthy to bring about the revolution. Today's entry is from the New York Times real estate section. It is titled, "The Island Brokers Are Overwhelmed. The wealthy want to escape the pandemic to a private, isolated paradise. The people who sell islands have to explain it's complicated." Apparently, the coronavirus pandemic has led to a lot of extremely wealthy people to try to buy islands, and the private island brokers are swamped with all of the different requests. The article points out, before the pandemic, an island was typically a vanity purchase that a wealthy client, usually male, would pursue sometime after retirement, brokers said. The island bug would usually strike a few years after the novelty of other luxury purchases had worn thin. Quote, "You have your yacht, your jet, now you want your island," said John Christie, the president of Christie's International Real Estate. So it's rough out there for all sorts of Americans during the pandemic. You know, you've got the folks whose unemployment benefits are running out. You've got the people who are, you know, trying to avoid getting evicted. And then you have the poor folks who just need more information about how to buy an island to hunker down in until we get a vaccine.
I'll have to check the next Christie's catalog to see what islands may still be available. John Bennett, top that.
I don't know if I can, but I will say I certainly want my own island for a lot of reasons. But I will also stay on brand. Bill, you know I like to use this to talk about something other than politics, to talk about sports. And yes. I was amazed on Sunday as I sat right here and watched the Washington football team trot out one Alex Smith to play quarterback just 2 years after he had a very gruesome compound fracture in one of his legs and thought he would never play again, even at, I think, 37 or 38. And he had this amazing rehab and recovery. And a month or so ago was activated for all football activities. And after being carted off on the same field, he had to come in backup duty for the backup who was starting because of this dysfunctional franchise benching their young quarterback, Dwayne Haskins, for the backup quarterback, Kyle Allen, brought in by their latest head coach, Riverboat Ron Rivera. And all of this played out in typical, and I'm going to use the word, Redskins fashion, because the dysfunction is linked to that now former name. But it was just, and then we're trying to watching Alex Smith try to play quarterback against these huge athletes who were chasing him around, and just grimacing on my couch as 300-pound defensive linemen were literally jumping on his back, all of that weight on that repaired and we hope healed leg. The fact that they let Alex Smith go out there and play quarterback, I thought said a lot about a franchise. And Bill, I did some research last night while we were waiting on the town halls. A franchise that since I moved here in 2002 has had, and I hope you're sitting down, 20 starting quarterbacks and 7 head coaches. That is your stat of the week. And that is, those numbers just embody the complete dysfunction that this football franchise has become under Dan Snyder. And who knows, Bill, you may play quarterback on Sunday.
I'm suited up and ready to go. Well, I must admit, for my favorite story of the week, and I don't hold this against you, Amanda, but my favorite story of the week also was that Senate debate last night in Iowa between Teresa Greenfield and Joni Ernst. I was just struck, and it takes me back the first time I ever went to Iowa as a journalist to cover the straw poll in Ames, Iowa, years ago. and I got a rental car at the airport, and I'm driving out to Ames from Des Moines, and I'm hearing them talk about the price of sow bellies and soybeans and corn. And I thought, this really happens. This is what Iowa is all about. And last night, to see Teresa Greenfield, who was asked about the price of corn, and she nailed it. And Joni Ernst, who grew up in a farm, was way off on the price of soybeans. She said it was $5.50, whatever per pound or whatever liter, whatever that the measurement is. And the actual price is $10.05. She probably lost her bid for reelection at that very moment.
I really agree. I think if she does lose and Greenfield has closed the gap, people will look to that moment. And I thought it was such an interesting moment because a lot of these Senate races have kind of all gone national this year. And that was really taking it back to being a typical local state race there in Iowa.
Yep. So soybeans wins the night for Teresa Greenfield. Amanda, how can people follow you on 19th News on Twitter?
It's just at Amanda Becker.
At Amanda Becker. How about you, Matt?
At Matt Gertz.
Oh, all right. John Bennett.
At Bennett John T. That's two N's and two T's.
All right. You got it. Hey, thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, John. And also for all of you listening, we have a very special treat for you. We talked earlier about Senator Ben Sasse and his very candid, he thought behind the door remarks, which are now public remarks, to a group of constituents on a conference call. We're going to play now the entire 9 minutes of Ben Sasse, so you can just see what a Republican senator really does think about Donald Trump behind closed doors, and you bet he is not the only one.
I think, like a lot of Nebraskans, I'm trying to understand your relationship with the president. Why do you have to criticize him so much?
Sure. So that is a very fair question. And I guess I kind of think about it like this. I think we should distinguish between policy agreement and policy disagreement, and then also long-term political implications as well. So I've worked hard to develop a good working relationship with the president over the last 3.5 years. I obviously campaigned for a lot of other people in the 2016 cycle. But Donald Trump is our president now, so I've worked hard to develop a good relationship with him. He's got a hard job, and we're called to pray for our leaders. So that's what we do regularly at the breakfast table at our house, is we pray for the president and the first lady and for Vice President Pence in their callings. And there are obviously a number of issue areas where President Trump and I have policy alignment now, or maybe a better way to put it is where the president has now adopted traditionally Republican positions that he used to reject for the majority of his life when he was funding Democratic candidates. So, for example, one of the places where he's changed, as we were just mentioning to the last questioner, is I think he's nominated truly great judges, and I've worked with him on that. In fact, I went on the Judiciary Committee after he was elected. Explicitly to advocate for the kind of originalists and constitutionalists that he had put on his list and that he had agreed to nominate. I'm the first Nebraskan on the Judiciary Committee in, I think, 46 years. I'm 48 years old, and I'm the first Nebraskan on the committee since the mid-70s. So there are definitely places where we agree. But as your question says, there are obviously a lot of places where he and I differ as well. And these aren't just mere policy issues. I'm not at all apologetic for having fought for my values against his in places where I think his are deficient, not just for a Republican, but for an American. So the way he kisses dictators' butts, I mean, the way he ignores that the Uyghurs are in literal concentration camps in Xinjiang right now. He hasn't lifted a finger on behalf of the Hong Kongers. I mean, he and I have a very different foreign policy. It isn't just that he fails to lead our allies. It's that the United States now regularly sells out our allies under his leadership. The way he treats women and spends like a drunken sailor, the ways I criticize President Obama for that kind of spending, I've criticized President Trump for as well. He mocks evangelicals behind closed doors. His family has treated the presidency like a business opportunity. He's flirted with white supremacists. I mean, the places where we differed on COVID. He, at the beginning of the COVID crisis, he refused to treat it seriously for months. He treated it like like a news cycle PR crisis rather than a multi-year public health challenge, which is what it is. And I mean, in his partial defense here, I think that lots of the news media has pretended that COVID is literally the first public health crisis ever, and somehow it's Donald Trump's fault. That's not true. They just wanted to use it against him. But the reality is that he careened from curb to curb. First, he ignored COVID, and then he went into full economic shutdown mode. He was the one who said 10 to 14 days of shutdown would fix this, and that was always wrong. I mean, and so I don't think the way he's led through COVID has been reasonable or responsible or right. And so these are some of the important policy or sort of leadership places where we differed, stuff we don't see eye to eye on. And I think that it's my duty to level with Nebraskans, even though I recognize that a lot of our voters in Nebraska are Trumpier than I am, and they sometimes get frustrated with me. But I also think voters have told me the most common thing I hear from Nebraskans is they have a very mixed perspective on the president. They think he does some stuff well, they think he does some stuff poorly. And the truth of the matter is, I think he's done some stuff well and some poorly. And so I've been honest about that. But those are kind of policy and leadership issues. I think it's also worth, for those of us who care about the party of Lincoln and Reagan, we should distinguish between policy and politics, because my dissents from President Trump are not only about policy, but it's also a prudential question or a political question about whether or not he's ultimately driving the country further to the left, because that's what I think is ultimately going to happen because of Donald Trump. This has been my fear for 5 years. It's why I campaigned for everybody not named Trump in 2016. And that is because I think folks have regularly misunderstood the meaning of 2016. Donald Trump didn't win the presidency because America actually wants more reality TV, round-the-clock, stupid political obsessions. I just don't think that that's what my neighbors want. It's not what I hear when I travel the state. I've spent lots of the last year on a campaign bus. And when you listen to Nebraskans, they don't really want more rage-tweeting as a new form of entertainment. I think the overwhelming reason that President Trump won in 2016 was simply because Hillary Clinton was literally the most unpopular candidate in the history of polling. We've had polls going back about 85 years, and Hillary Clinton is by far the worst presidential candidate America has ever had. General election presidential candidate. And I think that's why President Trump won, not because he laid out a constructive vision of the country that Americans united around. And so I think it's always been imprudent for my party, again, as I mentioned, calling it the party of Lincoln and Reagan. Those are the heights of American history. It has always been imprudent for our party to try to tie itself to a Trumpian brand. And that's what I've been worried about for 5 years. And so for months, as I've been campaigning, over the end of 2019 and all of 2020 again, I've been straight with Nebraskans that I'm worried that if President Trump loses, as looks likely, that he's going to take the Senate down with him. And if conservatives lose the Senate, here's what progressives are going to try to do. They're going to fracture the deliberative structure of the Senate. That's what blowing up the filibuster means. And that's the whole ballgame. They're going to add states. They're going to pack the Supreme Court. And that puts religious liberty in the broader First Amendment at risk. And that's the heart of who we are as Americans, as people who understand that government doesn't give us our rights. God gives us our rights via nature, and government is just our shared project to secure those things. And Donald Trump doesn't steward that. He doesn't do storytelling to the next generation. And now Senate Democrats, if they get to a supermajority that they can end the filibuster, I'm worried that some of the most, you know, terrible nuttiness that we see happening on campus will get imported into our jurisprudence. And that would be a terrible remaking of America. And so from where I sit, as one of the most conservative guys in the U.S. Senate, I'm now looking at the possibility of a Republican bloodbath in the Senate. And that's why I've never been on the Trump train. It's why I didn't agree to serve on his reelection committee, and it's why I'm not campaigning for him, because I spend all my time thinking about the one political question that's most central next month, which is holding the U.S. Senate. If we don't, I'll pull up and get back to questions here, Tyler, but I just think if we don't retain the Senate, there's a very good chance that 10 years from now, you're going to have a Venezuela-like, you know, dozens of members of the Supreme Court. You can imagine 30, 40 people on the Supreme Court at some point. And when all of our allies in the Pacific have sided with China because Trump's isolationism was so weak, that our allies began to doubt for the first time since World War II whether they could trust in U.S. strength and U.S. will and U.S. courage and U.S. virtue and values. If young people become permanent Democrats because they've just been repulsed by the obsessive nature of our politics, or if women who were willing to still vote with the Republican Party on 2016 decide that they need to turn away from this party permanently in the future, the debate is not going to be, you know, Ben Sasse, why were you so mean to Donald Trump? It's going to be, what the heck were any of us thinking that selling a TV-obsessed, narcissistic individual to the American people was a good idea? It is not a good idea. I think we are staring down the barrel of a blue tsunami, and we've got to hold the Senate, and so that's what I'm focused on. I'm not focused on Donald Trump. I think the media has done a terrible job of making us all believe that the presidency is always the most important thing for people to talk about. First of all, politics shouldn't be the center of our conversation or our life or our culture or our economics. But even inside politics, the presidency shouldn't be the center of that. And I think that Donald Trump and the media are united in wanting to make him the center of every conversation. And I think overwhelmingly, the most important political issue we face right now is whether or not Republicans can retain it. And so that's what I'm spending my time and energy on. Thanks for your question. Tyler, who's next?
And with that little revealing moment from Ben Sasse, we thank you for joining us on today's roundtable. Thanks also to our panelists, Amanda Becker, John Bennett, and Matt Gertz. Thank you all for listening, for joining us for the roundtable. Be strong, be safe, and come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.